This is a reading of the book composed of two lecture cycles entitled The Spiritual Hierarchies in the Physical World and Reality and Illusion, 15 lectures by Rudolf Steiner. Begin with the first cycle, The Spiritual Hierarchies in the Physical World, Lecture 1, entitled The Renewal of Primeval Wisdom, given on April 12, 1909, in the morning. This cycle of lectures will lead us into exalted regions of spiritual life, will lead us, as it were, not only from our earthly dwelling place into the vastness of physical space, but even into the spiritual worlds from which the physical aspect of space originates. At the same time, however, precisely a lecture cycle of this kind will show us that all knowledge and all wisdom aim to solve the greatest riddle of all, the riddle of the human being. For, to understand the human being, what illumines the riddle must be drawn from far distant spheres. This is to say that anyone wishing to understand these lectures must be acquainted with the basic concepts of theosophy, anthroposophy, which happens to be the case with those present. Therefore, always taking care to make these matters gathered from distant spheres as understandable as possible, we shall set the course of our spiritual flight at an especially high level in these lectures. When we speak of what are called the spiritual hierarchies, the eyes of our soul should turn upward to those beings who exist above earthly humanity. With our physical eyes, which perceive what is visible, we can rise, as it were, only through beings representing 4 degrees of one hierarchy, the mineral, plant, animal, and human worlds. Beyond that, above humanity, begins a realm of invisible beings, which, if we have developed the ability to do so, we can investigate with supersensible cognition. Then we rise toward beings and powers in the invisible, supersensible world, who form a continuation of the 4 stages found on Earth. You are all familiar with the fact that knowledge and investigation of these realms arose not only in our own historical period of human development, and that research into them is not limited to the present. In truth, there exists what we might call a primeval world wisdom, in which everything that we as human beings can fathom, know, and discern, all the concepts and ideas we can acquire, and all we can attain through clairvoyant imagination, inspiration, and intuition, has been prefigured in deed and in knowledge by the beings who stand above us. To use a trivial comparison, we might invoke the metaphor of the watchmaker, who first conceives the idea for a watch and then sets out to make it. The watchmaker constructs the watch according to ideas that have been envisioned prior to its construction. Later, we can take the watch apart, analyze it, study it, and thus reconstruct the watchmaker's thoughts from which the watch arose. In this way, we can rethink, think through again, the watchmaker's thoughts. In fact, in our present stage of evolution, this relationship, that of thinking through again, is the only one we can have as human beings to the primeval universal wisdom, that is, to the spiritual beings who stand above us. Spiritual beings originally had the imaginations, inspirations, and intuitions, the ideas and thoughts according to which the world surrounding us was created. Human beings can recover these thoughts and ideas in the world, and if they rise to clairvoyant perception, they can also discover the imaginations, inspirations, and intuitions through which one can gain access once more to the realm of spiritual beings. We may therefore say that even before our world came into existence, the wisdom of which we are going to speak already existed. The wisdom is the plan of the world. How far, then, must we go back and still remain within the limits of reality, if we want to find this primeval universal wisdom? Must we go back to some historical period when this or that great teacher was teaching? Indeed, we could learn much if we could go back here or there within historical epochs and become students of the great teachers. But to gain access to the highest manifestations of primeval wisdom, we must go back to a time when there was not yet any outwardly visible earth, when there was no world perceptible to the senses. For the world originated out of wisdom itself, and this wisdom according to which the divine spiritual beings formed our world was later bestowed upon humankind. Human beings in their thinking could then perceive the thoughts according to which the gods shaped the world. And after this primeval wisdom, this wisdom of cosmic creation, had evolved through several forms, it came, as you know, following the great Atlantean epochs, to the ancient holy rishis of our first post-Atlantean culture, to the great teachers of India. The form in which the primeval wisdom appeared through the holy rishis is hardly conceivable to human beings today. For human capacities of thinking and perception have changed considerably since the great teachers of India first taught post-Atlantean humanity. If we were to repeat today what the holy rishi said, most souls anywhere on earth would merely hear so many words. To understand the wisdom that was imparted to post-Atlantean humanity, quite other powers of comprehension are necessary than those we have in our time. All that has been recorded of this wisdom, all that is to be found in the best books regarding this original cosmic wisdom, represents only a faint echo of it. In many respects, it is obscured and darkened wisdom. No matter how sublime the Vedas appear to us today, or how beautiful the songs or gathas of Zarathustra sound to us, or how gloriously the ancient wisdom of Egypt speaks to us. Indeed, we can never sufficiently express our admiration for such documents. They provide only a dull reflection of the original wisdom of Hermes, the great teaching of Zarathustra, or the sublime knowledge proclaimed by the ancient rishis. Yet this sublime wisdom was preserved and could always be found in certain small circles guarding the mysteries, which is the term by which this knowledge is known. This primeval wisdom of humanity was preserved in the mysteries of India, Persia, Chaldea, and Egypt, as well as in the Christian mysteries, as these have existed up to our own time. Indeed, until recently, one could reach an understanding of living wisdom, not just of wisdom as it is found in books, only in these narrow circles. In the course of these lectures, however, it will become clear that what was kept alive in small circles must today penetrate into the masses of humanity to a greater extent than before. The stream of the ancient wisdom, that of the rishis, for example, never dried up. It continued to flow, as if through a renewing fountain, up to the time that we recognize as the beginning of our own era. This primeval divine wisdom, which streamed over humanity in ancient times, was transmitted by Zarathustra and his pupils, the Chaldean and Egyptian teachers. It streamed into the Mosaic revelation and came forth again with a new impulse, as if renewed in a rejuvenating fountain, in the earthly appearance of Christ. But following Christ's appearance, that is, since the time of the outward proclamation of Christianity, indeed as a result of it, the stream of primeval wisdom became so deep, so inward in character, that it could flow into humanity again only gradually. In other words, we can see that since the time of the outward promulgation of Christianity in the world, the primeval wisdom flowed slowly and gradually into humankind in a most elementary beginning. Its message may be found in the Gospels and in other Christian writings that contain the wisdom of the holy rishis in a form that has been renewed in a rejuvenating fountain. But how was this message understood at the beginning of the Christian epoch, the time period created for its purification, its reformation. The least part of it was understood through proclamation of the Gospels, and only gradually did the Gospels work through to a broader understanding. Indeed, in many ways, the Gospels worked more toward a darkening of understanding. Today, for most people, the Gospels are the most completely sealed of books. In the future, however, those who allow themselves to be renewed by the ancient cosmic wisdom will understand them. Because of this, the treasures lying in the shafts of Christian revelation, which are none other than the treasures of Eastern wisdom, except that they were born from restored powers, were preserved in narrow circles, and subsequently prolonged in various mystery societies, such as the Brotherhood of the Holy Grail and the Brotherhood of the Rosicrucians. These treasures of truth have been closely guarded. They were accessible only to those who, having passed through stringent trials, had prepared themselves to receive this living wisdom. Thus for centuries, following the beginning of our era, the treasures of Eastern and Western wisdom were almost inaccessible to most human beings. Some small amount of this wisdom trickled here and there into the outer world, but for the most part it remained a secret of the new mysteries. Thus the time has now come when the contents of the primeval cosmic wisdom may be brought in an appropriate form to many more people. Since the last third of the 19th century, one may speak of the primeval wisdom in a more or less unveiled form. Because of certain events in the spiritual world, the guardians of the mysteries have been permitted to allow some of the ancient wisdom to flow out into the world at large. You are all familiar with the evolution of the Theosophical Society, and must realize that the impetus for its development accompanied the proclamation of certain truths, in a form I need not describe here, known as the title Stanzas of Dzogchen, which are included in title The Secret Doctrine. These stanzas do, in fact, contain some of the deepest and most significant fragments of wisdom. Much of this wisdom originated in the teachings of the holy rishis that flowed into the sacred lore of the East. There is also much in them that streamed into Western Europe after the rejuvenating impulse of Christianity had occurred. The stanzas of Dzogchen contain not only wisdom preserved in the East, but also much that shines like a bright light through the centuries of our era into the Middle Ages and the mystery schools of the West. Much of what is to be found in the stanzas will only gradually be understood in all its depths. It must be made clear that they contain a wisdom that cannot yet be understood in the widest theosophical circles, nor fathomed with the exoteric capacities of the present day. It is a hopeless task, indeed, to attempt to interpret this important realm exoterically. After the ice had been broken by the development of theosophy, one could speak more freely out of the wellsprings of Western occultism, itself a continuation of Eastern occultism that had been transplanted to meet the different spiritual and physical conditions of life in the West. Today, however, the time has come to speak out of the sources of the living occultism faithfully guarded in the Rosicrucian mysteries. There is no wisdom of the East that has not streamed into Western occultism. In the teachings and investigations of the Rosicrucians, indeed, you will find everything that has been preserved by the great sages of the East. Nothing, absolutely nothing, known through Eastern wisdom is missing in the wisdom of the West. There is only this difference. The wisdom of the West had to illuminate this whole body of Eastern teaching with the light kindled in humanity by the Christ impulse, but without losing any of it. It should not be said that a single iota of Eastern occultism is missing from Western occultism, which is derived from the hidden rishis of the West who are invisible to human eyes. Nothing is missing. It is simply that everything had to be renewed out of the rejuvenating fountain of the Christ impulse. The great wisdom of the supersensible worlds as it was first uttered by the holy rishis, must resound again in what is now proclaimed about the spiritual hierarchies, and their reflection into the physical world. Just as Euclid's geometry has not become other than it once was, though one teaches and learns it today with new human capacities, so the wisdom of the holy rishis has not become something other than it once was, even though we teach and learn it with capacities kindled by the Christ impulse. Much of what we have to say about the spiritual worlds may thus be called Eastern wisdom. There should be no misunderstandings in these matters. Unfortunately, however, misunderstandings occur all too easily. Those who do not want to raise themselves from misinterpretation to genuine understanding may easily misunderstand what was said yesterday in the Easter lecture. Footnote, see Lecture 8, Cologne, April 11, 1909, The Event of Golgotha, The Brotherhood of the Holy Grail, The Spiritual Fire. This is in The Principle of Spiritual Economy. End of footnote. I mention this so that we can penetrate to a fuller understanding. Those, however, who do not wish to do so might say the following. Yesterday you spoke of the great so-called divine truths of the Buddha. You say that the Buddha taught and revealed the divine truths about suffering in one's life, that birth is suffering, illness is suffering, old age is suffering, death is suffering, that to be separated from loved ones and what one loves is suffering, that to be united with one, with what one does not love is suffering, that to be denied what one desires is suffering. But you also said that if we were to consider post-Christian times and those who truly understood the Christ impulse, then we would become aware that through the understanding and penetration of this Christ impulse, the ancient holy truths of Buddha concerning suffering in human life would no longer be entirely valid. For with the Christ impulse comes healing for suffering in life. You have said, Buddha teaches that birth is suffering. But one who understands Christ answers, through birth we enter a life which we share with Christ, and through Christ's participation the suffering of life is extinguished. Even so, the healing power of the Christ impulse eradicates illness. For one who truly understands the Christ, illness, death, and so forth are no longer suffering. Further objections to what you have said might also be made, but I can show you that the same words may be found in the holy writings of the Buddha and in the Gospels. There, too, it is said that life, illness, and so on are suffering. Therefore, it might be assumed superficially that although we possess these modern religious documents, their contents were already present in Buddhism. And from this one might conclude that there is no progress or development in the various religions since they all embody the same truths. But you have spoken of progress, and have told us that the ancient holy truths of Buddhism are no longer true because of Christianity. End of quote. For someone to come to this conclusion, from what I said, would be a most grievous misconception, because this is not even implied. Certainly, all of the above was said, with the exception of the last sentence. In matters as subtle as these, it is important to develop a precise understanding. But this can be understood only by one who has developed a capacity for objectivity, certainly not by a fanatic. One who speaks from the source of Rosicrucian wisdom and research will never attack the contents of the writings of the great Buddha, nor claim that anything in them is untrue. Such a person, speaking from the Rosicrucian source, supports Buddha's insights and the whole of Eastern wisdom, and denies none of it. What the Buddha beheld of the great truths of the suffering in life, through illumination in his inner being, is correct in every detail. Nothing, absolutely nothing, may be taken away from these truths. And precisely because everything that the Buddha said, that birth, illness, old age, death, and so on are suffering, is true, the Christ impulse is for us such a powerful and important means of healing. For Christ puts an end to this suffering. This is true because even though the sufferings in life exist, an even greater impulse above the world can lift them up out of the world. The Christ could be effective precisely because the Buddha proclaimed the truth. Humanity had to be led down from spiritual heights, where primeval world wisdom was active in its purest form. Humankind had to be guided to independence on the physical plane. As a result, life and illness became suffering. But a powerful remedy for these irrefutable facts had to appear in the course of evolution. Does a person deny the reality of the situation by claiming that though the facts are true, at the same time a remedy has been given gradually to heal the situation produced by the facts? There is no question of Buddhism opposing Christianity or vice versa in the lofty heights of the spheres of the spiritual hierarchies. There the Buddha stretches out his hand to Christ, and Christ reaches out to the Buddha. But if we fail to recognize an ascending development in human evolution, we also fail to recognize the most spiritual deed that has occurred in earthly evolution, namely the deed of Christ. Thus the wisdom of the East that brought us the wisdom of the holy rishis, along with the primeval cosmic wisdom, is not to be denied. But over long periods of time, during which this wisdom streamed into humankind, it became increasingly difficult for the masses of people who had no access to the sources of the mysteries to understand this wisdom. Precisely the understanding itself became difficult. In ancient Atlantean times, before the great catastrophe, the mass of humanity was still endowed with ancient, albeit dulled, powers of clairvoyance. When human beings turned their gaze to the heavenly expanses, to the spiritual hierarchies, they saw differently from humanity in later, post-Atlantean times. For by then, the old clairvoyance had disappeared for the great mass of humanity, who now gazed into the physical expanses of the heavens with only physical eyes. Before the Atlantean catastrophe, there was no point in speaking as we do today of heavenly bodies spread out in space. The clairvoyant human eye, EYE, which gazed into the expanses of space at that time, saw spiritual worlds. It would have been meaningless then to speak of Mercury, Neptune, Saturn, and so on, as astronomy speaks of them today. When astronomy today speaks of the cosmos and its contents, it can report only what the sense-perceiving physical eye sees when it looks into the heavens. This was by no means the case for ancient clairvoyant humanity in Atlantean times. Human beings did not see physical, finite, shining stars then. What we see today with the physical eye is merely an outward expression of the spiritual reality that human beings beheld in former times. Today, when we look with our physical eye through a telescope to where Jupiter stands in the heavens, it sees, so to speak, a physical globe surrounded by moons. But what did the ancient Atlanteans see when they looked clairvoyantly at the same spot? During Atlantean times, the physical eye saw much as we do today when we try to see something through a thick autumn mist. The light is surrounded by a kind of misty aura, and disappears in the colored rings that form around it. The eye of an Atlantean would not have seen the physical star of Jupiter. It would have seen something that is still today united with Jupiter, but which humanity can no longer see, namely the aura of Jupiter, that is, the spiritual beings whose outward expression is the physical planet. Before the Atlantean catastrophe, the human spiritual eye, EYE, swept the expanses of the universe and beheld spiritual beings everywhere. At that time, one could speak only in terms of a spiritual content. It would have been meaningless to talk about physical stars at an evolutionary stage when the physical eye was not yet open, as it is today. Gazing into the vast wide spaces of the universe, Human beings then actually beheld spiritual beings, spiritual hierarchies. They saw beings. The following comparison may help us to understand the course of evolution. Let us imagine ourselves in a thick fog, where we cannot see each separate light, because everything is shrouded in a misty aura. Then the fog lifts suddenly, and the individual lights become plainly visible, but as a result, the auras are no longer seen. In earlier epochs, the human eye beheld the aura of Jupiter. It saw in it the spiritual beings belonging to Jupiter at that particular stage of the planet's evolution. But as humanity developed, the capacity of physical sight also developed. The aura remained, of course, even though human beings could no longer see it. At the same time, the physical center gradually became more clearly visible. Thus, the spiritual counterpart was lost as the physical aspect became manifest. But the knowledge of the spiritual beings who surround the stars was preserved in the mysteries and spoken of by the holy rishis. When humanity was capable only of physical sight, the holy rishis still spoke of the spiritual atmosphere, of the spiritual populations in the cosmic bodies that are distributed through space. Consider the situation that then arose. Within the sanctuaries of knowledge, one could speak of the spiritual beings surrounding the cosmic bodies. Outside them, however, as sense perceptions became increasingly sharper, people came to speak more and more in terms of physical matter. Yet when the holy rishis spoke the word mercury, of course they never actually used this word, but let us use it to make ourselves clear, did they mean the physical orb in the cosmos? No, not even the ancient Greeks, when speaking of Mercury, referred to the physical planet. When the Greeks spoke of Mercury in their sanctuaries of knowledge, they spoke of spiritual worlds, spiritual beings. When the disciples of the teachers in the sanctuaries of knowledge spoke the words Moon, Mercury, Venus, Sun, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in their various languages, these words represented a gradation of spiritual beings. Anyone who refers to a physical planet with such a word today omits the most important aspect and characterizes only the coarsest aspect of what originally was encompassed in the terms Moon, Mercury, Venus, and so on. Spiritual teachers in ancient times sought to evoke the idea of a powerful spiritual realm. When they pointed to the place in the heavens where the moon was, they were aware that the lowest rank of the spiritual hierarchies dwelt there. But when human beings, who had been cut off from spiritual vision by their increasingly sensory perceptions, looked up, they saw only the physical moon, which they then called the moon, one word for two things, that although connected, called forth quite different representations in human minds. When teachers in the stream of spiritual wisdom referred to Mercury, Sun, and Mars, they meant something quite different from these words than teachers do in the materialistic sense. In the materialistic stream. The two streams, the spiritual and the materialistic, drifted further and further apart. In the mysteries, the words that later came to denote the external heavenly bodies had always referred to supersensible worlds, to a sequence of spiritual realms. The outer world always understands the words to mean the material aspect, and this is true even of the contemporary mythology, I use the word deliberately, we call astronomy. Spiritual science recognizes the full value of all mythologies. Thus it also appreciates the worth of the mythology called modern astronomy, which sees only space filled with physical cosmic bodies. This modern mythology is, for one who truly knows, merely a particular phase of all mythologies. A single thread runs through these mythologies, from the ancient European sagas of the gods to the myths of the Greeks and Romans, the obscure myths of the Middle Ages, and the fully justified and admirable ones founded by Copernicus, Kepler, and Galileo. A time will come when people will say of modern mythology, "In the past, there were human beings who thought it correct to place the material sun in the center of an ellipse and to rotate the planets in ellipses around it. They constructed a cosmic universal system, even as earlier people had done before them. But today we know that it is all mere saga and legend." Indeed, a time will come when, no matter how much the old mythologies are now despised by the modern world, it will be considered absurd to speak of a Copernican mythology. To realize this will help us to understand how words have been interpreted so differently over the course of time. Nevertheless, the primeval cosmic wisdom flowed on exoterically, because it was increasingly interpreted in a materialistic way. It was understood less and less. True spiritual insight ebbed away. Yet when ancient wisdom was restored at the beginning of our era, human beings were again directed to the starry realms, so that humanity might not completely lose its connection with primeval spiritual wisdom. They were told in clear, direct words that when they looked up to the heavens with their physical eyes, they would find there not only a material universe, but also realms filled with spirit. The most intimate pupil of St. Paul, Dionysius the Areopagite, clearly proclaimed in Athens that out in space there was not only matter, but that when the soul arose with inner awareness into the expanses of the universe, it would find spiritual beings who are above humanity in evolutionary development. Dionysius coined different terms from those used previously, for otherwise people would have thought that he referred only to material entities. When the rishis spoke of spiritual hierarchies, their words expressed what Greek and Roman wisdom expressed in their ascending universe of Moon, Mercury, Mars, Venus, Jupiter, and Saturn. Dionysius, the pupil of St. Paul, had in mind the same worlds the rishis spoke of. Dionysius clearly wished to emphasize that he was referring to spiritual matters, so he deliberately chose words he knew would be taken spiritually. That is, he spoke of angels, archangels, archai, powers, mights, dominions, thrones, cherubim and seraphim. But people had completely forgotten what they once knew. If the connection between the terminology of Dionysius the Areopagite and the rishis had been understood, one would have known that the moon the rishis referred to and the angelic realm in other mysteries are one and the same thing. One might have heard the word Mercury on the one hand and the word archangel on the other. And would have known that they are one and the same. Archai and Venus refer to the same realm, as do sun and powers. On hearing the word Mars, one would have had the feeling of rising to the mights. The word dominions in the school of Dionysius corresponds to Jupiter, and the term Saturn to the thrones. In wider circles, this knowledge has disappeared and was no longer known. As science became more and more materialistic, the old names, which had once denoted spiritual realities, remained, but now increasingly they applied only to matter. In contrast to this materialistic stream, there did exist a spiritual stream that referred to archangels, angels, and so on. But this stream had lost the connection with the physical expression of these spiritual beings. Thus we see how primeval cosmic wisdom penetrated into the school founded by St. Paul through Dionysius, and how it is a question now of permeating newfound knowledge with the spiritual impulse of the past. Indeed, it is the task of spiritual science or anthroposophy to renew the bond between the physical and the spiritual, between the world of the earth and the spiritual hierarchies. For the spiritual aspect of knowledge must always remain incomprehensible to those who do not know the true origin of ideas about the outer material world. This becomes particularly noticeable in writings that, although they contain only a faint echo of primeval cosmic wisdom, can be understood only by means of this wisdom. To exemplify the difficulties involved, take a passage from the celestial song, the Bhagavad Gita, which sheds considerable light on humanity's relation to the hierarchies. Chapter 8, beginning with verse 23, quote, "I will explain to you, seeker of truth," that is the usual translation, "under what circumstances the exalted spirits of gods depart through the gate of death in order to be reborn or not. I say to you, behold the fire, the day and the time of the waxing moon, and the months of the increasing light of the sun. Those who die at that time pass through the gate of death into Brahma. But those who die under the sign of smoke, in the night, at the time of the waning moon, during the portion of the year when the sun rests low in the sky, they pass through the gate of death in the lunar light, and return again to this world." Unquote. Dear friends, there is a passage from the Bhagavad Gita telling us that our progress, our successive incarnations, depends on whether we die in the sign of light by day, by waxing moon during the 6 months that the sun is high in the heavens, or whether we die in the sign of the smoke by night, when the moon is waning and the sun is low. That is the literal meaning of the passage. It says that those who pass through the gate of death in the sign of fire by day, by waxing moon, or when the sun is high in the heavens, need no longer return. But of the others, those who die in the sign of smoke by night, by waning moon, or during the 6 months when the sun is low, it says that they cannot rise to the level of Brahma, but only to the height of the moon, and must therefore return again. This passage in the celestial song of the East presents untold difficulties to those who seek an exoteric interpretation. It can only be explained when light is shed upon it from spiritual knowledge. Indeed, the same light from which the passage was written continues to shine in the mystery schools. Rejuvenated through Christianity, it is a light that illumines the bond between moon and angels, Mercury and archangels, Venus and Archai, and so on. Through the light provided by spiritual knowledge, we shall find the key to this passage we have chosen as an example. It will be the starting point for our lecture this evening. Once we have discovered this key, we shall be able to rise to an understanding of the spiritual hierarchies. The end of Lecture 1.